Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Seb Stafford-Bloor of TIFO Football. No disrespect intended, but it's sometimes difficult to imagine there are two teams in Saturday's FA Cup final. Most of the attention, understandably, is on Liverpool and their compelling season. But in many ways, the final is more important to Chelsea. This is a club that defines itself through trophies. It's also a club at a crossroads on and off the field. A simple question, although the situation is pretty complicated, Seb. Will this season, let's say this era at Chelsea, end on a winning note?
No, I don't think so. I think Liverpool are too strong, they're playing too well. One of the difficulties you have at this time of the season is that clubs sort of portion off their commitment and motivation depending on which competition they're playing. And at the same time, I think it's quite difficult for them to turn that on and off. And Chelsea have been in this kind of weird zombie-like state in the league for a couple of weeks now. Their standards have slipped very, very dramatically, have done since probably the Real Madrid defeat in the Champions League. And yes, Liverpool suffered a little bit of a setback against Tottenham last weekend, but they remain the best club team in the world for me. They have huge amounts of power. Also, very troublingly for Chelsea, all of Liverpool's attacking strength is aimed at a defensive unit, which is looking extremely tenuous. And the parts that aren't looking tenuous are suffering from bad bouts of form. Edouard Mendy, the goalkeeper, is having probably his first extended rough period in English football, I'd say. He's a little bit down on where he was. And I think we've seen over the last couple of weeks, some of the moments that those defenders are coughing up have been pretty ugly. And of all the teams that you wouldn't want to face when that's the case, Liverpool right top of that list.
Yeah. The bankers and the bidders won't be on the pitch, Meigs. But do you think the takeover process has influenced performance, however marginally? Because as we all know, success is acquired at the margins, isn't it?
I think undeniably. I think there are a few aspects to it. So say if Chelsea were actually going for a title, or we're still in for a title when Abramovich was sanctioned and when the sale was offered, then I think there might have been a different dynamic. Because I do think the fact that they've kind of been in this strange, obviously not nowhere world, because they're probably going to be in the Champions League, but in this strange situation where it would take a lot for them to drop out of third place has kind of fed into this situation. And I think it worked both ways, where at the very start, the Abramovich situation almost created a defiance within the squad. That does happen in those situations. And Tuchel was initially really good at bringing it out, but that's always going to have a finite effect. And I think it's been replaced by something else, where it's been replaced by uncertainty. And uncertainty is basically, it's one of the worst things you can have at a football club. Because by the nature of professional sport, you need 100% unwavering focus to really compete at top level. That is the real mark. So if there's any sort of doubt of anything, that will start to have an effect, even if subconscious. And I think that's what's happened to the Chelsea squad in the last few weeks. Why we're seeing so many kind of drop points, so many aimless performances. Just that even if it's a 1-5% difference, that extra focus isn't there. And I think you can see in how Tuchel has spoken about it, how frustrated he's got about it. But all that said, maybe slightly disagree with Seb a little bit, because I think this is actually a genuinely 50-50 game, as much for the fact that for Liverpool, this is the least of the three trophies left that they're going for, or it's the one they want least. And for Chelsea, it's now basically their entire season. And I think that's actually one of those elements that can restore focus. And obviously, I'm not going to say that it's a half-motivated Liverpool. It'll be anything but. They'll be going for it. But there's just a subtle difference there, which I think maybe levels out the game a little bit. And let's not forget, at the very start of this, just a few days after the disgraceful invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and when really the first doubt about Chelsea came, because it was the first talk that Abramovich could be sanctioned, it was the League Cup final where both teams drew nil all. But okay, Liverpool ended up winning on penalties, but in the kind of balance of play, that was very much a 50-50 game. And I do think we could actually see similar on Saturday.
Yeah, I said in the intro, Seb, that this is a club that defines itself by trophies, but it's also a club at a crossroads. We're in a situation where they can't plan for the future. Recruitment deals, if they are being done, they're being done on trust at the moment, mm-hmm. aren't they? Because they can't be done officially. How complicated is it to run a football club and get an optimise a football team in these circumstances?
Well, I don't think it's difficult. I think it's impossible. In retrospect, actually, I think this was probably also the worst possible time for this to have happened to Chelsea, because apparently the right time to get rid of players is a year before it's too late. Okay. Now, if you look at that Chelsea team at the moment, I think we've covered the defence. A lot of, change needs to happen there. Rudiger's off. We know this. Defence looks very, very different without him. Thiago Silva is older than me. There needs to be a succession plan there. And there's a lack of quality in some of the positions. Chilwell comes back at fullback. That helps, clearly. Reece James is still on the other side. Great. But you got question marks elsewhere. So one of them I would say is N'Golo Kante, who is... he's been a wonderful player for a really, really long time. I would say that he's started to approach the kind of the downslope of his career. You need to have a plan for what happens after him. The Romelu Lukaku situation is extremely difficult and nebulous, and it has been for a long time. That needs a resolution. What's happening with Christian Pulisic? Don't know. Is Hakim Ziyech's future at Chelsea, is that where he is best? Is that the best place for him to spend what should be the peak of his career? Don't know. So what you have are all these unanswered questions and essentially an inability to answer any of them without kind of sort of favours and promises from a football transfer market and a network which, I don't know, not necessarily suited to that way of doing things, should we say. It's very, very difficult. Miguel mentioned right at the beginning, nothing worse than uncertainty in football. It's just poison for a football team. And so the result is mixed agendas, players starting to think about what they do next rather than what they're doing now. And the result is something not just, beneath optimal, but just a million miles away from it.
Mm. And in those circumstances, Migs, is the strain beginning to show on Thomas Tuchel?
Yeah, I think you can see it in his frustration. I've been at so many press conferences over the last while where Tuchel has basically vented. I also think it's maybe given him more free rein to make not necessarily decisions he fully won. Well, basically... essentially there's no repercussions for it. Say the Lukaku situation. Previously there was a whole political context there because Lukaku was one of Abramovich's signings or one of Marina's signings. So it did make me, ultimately it was very, very unlikely they were going to get rid this summer. Now Tuchel still refused to play in a lot of big games, but he had to be much more diplomatic and delicate about it all. Now we're not quite in that situation where basically he's been more open about what he said. He's left him out in more conspicuous moments. Like I know for a fact that on the Lukaku side, there's this feeling players always score against their old clubs. He left him on the bench for the entire game against Everton. So, but and usually in a situation like that, Tuchel could be like, all the talk be, remember what happened with Antonio Conte in 2017-18. Now, Tuchel's not quite to that level, and Conte actually won an FA Cup in that season. But I think we're in a similar sort of situation, or we're in a situation where he's kind of just, he's free to go as extreme as possible, say, with some of his decisions. There's no real constraints above him, which is, again, just a natural product situation, especially because of the fact we don't even know if Bruce Buck and Marina Granovskaya will be staying, although there are some indications they will be. And you'd wonder as well, I mean, I suppose, again, all of this will come down to his own conversations with the new owners. At least there's a little bit more clarity there now, because it's the Todd Bowley group who do seem to have gone about a lot around the club in the right way. But yeah, I think it undeniably has fed into this situation. And it'd be very interesting to see, say, I mean, with the biggest one of all there, whether Lukaku starts on Saturday. You'd have to think, given recent big games, that won't be the case. Although, of course, Lukaku scored what was probably, in that League Cup final we mentioned, he got a goal that really should have stood, because it didn't look offside. But let's see.
Mm. Well, with Lukaku, Tuchel has been, he's basically indulging in manager speak, which basically can never really truly disguise a breakdown in a relationship, both personally and professionally. He's basically saying Lukaku will remain an important part of the squad next season. But surely, and I'll use a phrase here that the new owner, who owns LA Dodgers as well, will probably understand. He is a likely trade candidate, isn't he, in the summer, Seb?
Well, you'd have thought so just because of his value. Like, if you were to... if Romelu Lukaku was to be made available in the summer of 2022, you'd still have enormous value, maybe not £100 million. But, and I think actually this feeds into a bigger question about Chelsea. We're semi-aware of the figures that have been paid and the sums of money that have been committed to the club. And I think a fair question is to ask, how do you make money out of Chelsea if it's not to trim, not the fat, but if you're not to kind of economise in certain places? You're not going to, if you're a new owner, and you're inheriting that, terribly difficult planning situation around the new ground, which prohibits you at the moment from making, any more substantial match day income. You're going to look at sort of inefficiencies, and Lukaku is currently one of them. And it seems to me, maybe Miguel can speak to this, with greater precision and much more insight, but it seems to me that you can't have Tuchel and Lukaku at that club for much longer. It just doesn't seem that way. I'm not suggesting there's anything personal between them. I just mean that there's clearly something a little bit wrong there. To me, looking at it from the outside, the lack of attempt to kind of work Lukaku into a system in the way that suits him has always been quite strange. That's something that I've struggled to understand, because the template for that existed at Inter Milan last year. That you can see that is exactly how you get the best out of Romelu Lukaku. And yet there's never been an obvious attempt, unless I've missed it, to kind of imitate those circumstances, to create that kind of context around Lukaku, tactical context around him. It's very strange, and it's been strange for a really long time, and I have no idea what the answer is, other than, a parting of the ways, I guess.
Yeah, if we are talking about that, it's going to be a busy summer, isn't it? Once this ownership deadline, which looks like end of May, goes through, obvious departures, Miggs, Kepa, Marcus Alonso maybe?
I mean, Kepa, I suppose, even that's influenced by the situation, just by the fact that it used to be about to sort of, they used to, the negotiations, that say Marina would drive, and they thought they had things in place. Maybe that becomes a little bit more difficult now. In fact, clubs might actually be sensing a certain vulnerability in Chelsea in that regard, given, I mean, this is another thing that feeds into it all, whereas we're obviously used to a version of Chelsea that's existed now for almost two decades, and it's very much a Abramovich era. Okay, and now it after about 5 years, the early fantasy football signings dissipated, but they were still obviously capable of spending money that most clubs couldn't. Whereas now, I mean, what's the likely reality now? It's probably maybe something closer to Arsenal or Spurs, where they have to be much more controlled. Now, Chelsea would argue that was the way it was going for the last few years anyway, but they still basically had a financial power, as the summer of 2020 illustrated, when they went on that, in a COVID market, when everyone else had to basically rein in, they went out and spent over 200 million. It feels unlikely that's going to happen anytime soon. They'll have to be much more of a kind of a trader club, where any incomings are based on outgoings, which makes the kind of future of those players all the more relevant and all the more influential. And then, of course, as you say, yes, there's a lot of players that are probably going to go and kind of on contracts. I mean, Azpilicueta, although there has been some suggestion he may stay a year. Now, given the recent form, there is probably possibly an argument that Azpilicueta is finally feeling the effect of so many games, brilliant servant as he's been. Yeah, I think Alonso is likely to go. Obviously, we know the Rudiger decision is made. And that's a lot of personality. Whatever about their current quality, that's a lot of personality from that defence that's going to require replacing. Suddenly you're desperate for Thiago Silva to stay just because of that necessary experience. It might well be another summer like 2019, conversely, where they really have to rely on their academy much more. But again, this is something that's all completely up in the air, and it doesn't mean that any transfer... And also, I think there's also another side to that where, because of course, this isn't just about Chelsea in and of themselves. Chelsea are basically in a race here with Manchester City and Liverpool. And one of the reasons Manchester City and Liverpool are so far ahead of everyone else is because of how well structured they are throughout, which basically means when it comes to transfers, they're usually kind of 6 to 18 months in advance. They're certainly not doing deals on the fly, which pretty much has to happen with Chelsea this summer. I mean, can you ever remember a situation where Chelsea have gone into a summer, basically, and we haven't had any transfer speculation?
Yeah.
even I know that's a very simple thing, but even that alone kind of points to the situation we're in. So, I mean, of course, Chelsea could, I think they could still be a Champions League club next season or finish top four. But this is a club that would have had designs on being up there with Liverpool and Man City. Certainly thought they were going to be going into this season. Now it just feels like they're going to fall away a fair bit. Or at least I suppose that's, I think, the fairest reading from the current situation. But again, let's see what happens when the new ownership actually sits in.
Mm. Do you think, you know, whatever happens, there will be a, you know, what's the usual political phrase, root and branch review and reform? They're going to have to look at the academy, as Meeks suggested there, Seb, and also perhaps their loan structuring.
You say root and branch reform, I think of badding and World Cups. That's where my mind goes. Like, I'm almost
too many to mention. Too many to mention.
You know, like sad little England players coming back from Heathrow. Well, the loan thing is what it is. I mean, it's been under construction, reconstruction for some time now. The days of the loan army are long gone, and I don't think there's anybody, you know, Conor Gallagher aside, who is coming back to take a first team spot immediately. To me, the really interesting thing that Miguel said, which I think is crucial, and which I think a lot of fans will miss, is this idea of transfers being done like 18 months to a year in advance. Like, we know that like Ziyech was completed 6 months before he arrived. Kai Havertz was a long-term kind of bit of work by Chelsea, which heavily involved Marina Granovskaya. And I think was the problem that the Chelsea are going to have beyond loans, beyond the academy, is if you look at the kind of the talent coming through the game. So if you think about some of the most desirable players in the sport at the moment, Erling Haaland and Kylian Mbappe, of course, yeah, they're already spoken for probably. But look at someone like, I don't know, Christopher Nkunku or RB Leipzig. Now, that's a really good example of someone that, like, if you were a properly functioning club, and if you were a club that sort of had its next 3-year cycle planned properly, you'd really be quite far down the line with Leipzig in trying to conclude that piece of business before, you know, you don't, as a big beast club, you don't get to July the 1st or June the 1st and be like, okay, lads, rub your hands together. What are we going to do this summer? That's not really how it works. And so Chelsea, by virtue of this situation, just because it hasn't been completed yet, they can't be anywhere. And you wonder, like, I don't know the answer to this, but you wonder how you address that. You wonder how you make up that ground, because at the top of the game, you miss out on a kind of a talent class like that, and you're 3 years behind. And I don't know what the future is. I mean, I think that the thing with the academy, and the same is really true with kind of the group of loan players, is back to what I said previously. Where does the money come from? Like, if we're thinking of this as a kind of a club, Chelsea sort of adopting more of an Arsenal, Tottenham model, then where are you taking the value to invest it back into the first team if you're not going to run on a benefactor model anymore? And so that obviously clearly has consequences for the academy and loans. And so, yeah, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea what comes next, but you can't compete with a kind of an ad hoc policy. So, yeah.
Mm. Because weren't cracks already emerging, Megs, in the recruitment strategy? You know, you see Tammy Abraham's renaissance in Rome. And when you look at the offensive players who've been brought in, you know, Pulisic, Ziyech, Werner, Havertz, isn't the nub of the problem that none of those players have had what they needed to have, which is a statement season?
Yeah, I feel like that. I mean, one of the kind of lines that's come out in the last few days is that, and again we come back to this issue, that Tuchel felt they needed a specific type of number 9 to fit into his team this season, and that could be what takes them up to the next level. Now the push is obviously for Lukaku, since then. And I suppose this isn't actually really a reflection of Lukaku as a player. It's more just about styles and styles make teams, where he basically wasn't the particular style that Tuchel was looking for. And that Tuchel has been surprised that there wasn't a due diligence done, or not due diligence, but I suppose that something like this wasn't seen. And the argument within football has been that this isn't something that would happen at Liverpool or Manchester City these days. And again, we have the contrast with just how easily Luis Diaz has adapted to both Liverpool and the Premier League. And I suppose maybe that does speak to an issue, but then it also speaks to a situation where, now, so some of this is a consequence of just basically the managers and how long they've been there, but where with City and Liverpool, they've all been building to a specific ideal for so long. Whereas with Chelsea, I mean, that squad alone is a product of how many different managerial regimes. And that means when even for a manager like Tuchel, it will take a few windows at least to try and to bring it closer to your own vision. And I think that's one of the ongoing issues at Chelsea right now. There's obviously now come into this, it's hit an unexpected impasse that creates even more uncertainty on the other end. And I think that's, I mean, because one of the things about Chelsea for some time under Tuchel is, even though he's seen, rightfully I would say, as a very progressive manager, and, you know, it's all the kind of modern principles, he's quite close to Guardiola in terms of approach. But I think because this Chelsea squad isn't truly his, they and they've never really cut loose in terms of attacking. There's only been certain games. And again, some of that is tied to the striker issue. But we given the array of talented forwards that they are, maybe more so talented or say potential in that squad, we've never really seen them link up in kind of great exhibitions, bar maybe the odd 7-0 against Norwich and that, but certainly not that statement attacking performance in a big game. And I think part of that is to do because it's such a kind of a squad that accommodates so many different, the ideas of so many managers and so many different kind of approaches, his initial instinct or his initial decision was basically just, right, we're going to put the right defensive structure in place. That'll make us hard to beat. Then we can build from there. But the issue is they're still building from there, and it's had the offset effect where suddenly, because of this uncertainty we're talking about, that structure now looks vulnerable and new.
I think one of the fascinating aspects of the final will be that both clubs emphasise the importance of wing backs or, you know, highly offensive full backs. You mentioned it earlier, just in passing, Seb, how much of Chelsea missed Ben Chilwell, and how do you see Reece James evolving as a player?
I think they've missed Ben Chilwell enormously. Marcus Alonso is such a funny player, isn't he? Like, I've never really thought he was particularly good, and yet he survives. Like, he's always there and he's always doing things. I think Ben Chilwell was a different category of footballer, both in terms of like his delivery from wide positions, also the kind of the patterns of his attacking influence. I think there's just a better technical player there. Reece James, to me, I think the really interesting thing with him is it's going to come in the next sort of year to 2 years, because clearly Chelsea are going to have to add to their defensive group at some point, replenish what they've lost. Now, what does Reece James's position become? Is he one of those kind of outside centre halves that you see in a back three? Because he can play that position really well. Does he become a proper wing back? And you'd be tempted to say yes, just because of how good his attacking contribution is. And he's one of the best crossers of the ball I've ever seen from his position in English football, without question. And just, he's part of that generation of wing back who they're happy coming centrally. Like previously, like fullback wingback's domain was the touchline. You overlap, you go past your winger sometimes, and you get to the byline. Anytime they would come inside and sort of go towards the teeth of a defence, at times they'd look like they're a little bit lost, and you'd see these kind of flaws in their technique or problems with their decision making. He looks entirely comfortable in that position. And so, like, his evolution to this point is very impressive, but I still feel that there's quite a long way to go on that front, because I don't think we've seen kind of the rainbow of his abilities yet. So he's fascinating. But yeah, you get those two back on the side full time, and it's a very different attacking proposition, because what you're able to, if you think about like your wing backs as temp pegs or creators of space or players who are able to kind of give your side a kind of attacking gear change, for want of a less sort of pretentious phrase, if you're without them, and I think this has been proven in all sorts of teams across the last 5 years, if you're without proper power at wing back, fullback, or you have an imbalance, or you take one out and leave one in, you look at the effect that that can have over the rest of a team. You could definitely make the argument that a fullback, wing back is the most important position in modern football, I think.
Yeah, given that, and you know, this is, you know, we're in danger of entering, you know, a cliched area of debate, which has never stopped us in the past, I have to admit.
Love the cliched area of debate.
Yeah. Exactly. We thrive on it. Chelsea, do you think they'll target Trent Alexander-Arnold, Migs?
Well, certainly the spacing behind him, which I think is the big one with Alexander-Arnold. Because I think it's obviously become a little bit of a flashpoint of debate, but rather than actually being a reflection on the player's ability, it's more just to kind of, as Seb has touched on there, just his role in the team, where really a wing back and a Klopp team, I suppose this points to where modern football is where it's actually both, and it's similar to pressing, given our central set, pressing is both at the exact same time a defensive and an attacking method of play or idea. And similar, a wing back and a Klopp team, or sorry, a wing back in this Klopp team. And this applies to both Robertson and Alexander-Arnold. Maybe Alexander-Arnold a little bit more because of the weapon that is his right foot. It's both a defensive position and an attacking position. But that defending, it doesn't come from the kind of nuts and bolts defensive work that we so associate with kind of your classic right back. It actually comes from, I was talking to an assistant coach at another Premier League club about this. And I said, where Liverpool really stand out, what makes them so difficult to play, it's the line, which is basically the two wing backs and the two number eights standing, working as a four, and they push up in unison so much that they basically pen you behind. That's actually what works defensively and attacking. But the issue, of course, is, and it's really difficult to exploit because you've got to be spot on to do it, but it does mean that there is an area behind those wing backs if you can get the ball there. And that's why it's become one way to at least get at Liverpool. In fact, I was at the Villarreal game last Tuesday, and both of their goals came from exactly that approach. In fact, both of their goals and the other big chance that was missed came from putting the ball in behind the wing-backs, one of them behind Trent Alexander-Arnold. And yeah, I think that's where we'll see maybe the most tactical intrigue, to use another cliche, in this match, in the space behind the wing-backs. Because that's where there's give in these teams.
Yeah. So how did Chelsea then, Seb, deal with the threat of Mo Salah? And when you think about it, he's almost being routinely double teamed and sometimes even triple teamed. Is it that you just try and smother him?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a blueprint in the work that Spurs did at Anfield last weekend, in that with a player like that, there's no perfect solution. There's no tactical plan which removes him from the game. You just kind of, you take your chances, you know, in the margins. So I think what Spurs did a good job of was packing the penalty box, inviting him back, well, sending him either down the touchline or inviting him back onto his left foot, but giving him absolutely no shooting angle, making sure that when he cuts back and he looks at that curve that he likes to put in the top corner, that you've got enough bodies between your goalkeeper and the ball. I don't quite know how Chelsea do that, because I think the group of Tottenham defenders at Anfield are slightly better at the moment than what Chelsea are able to field. I don't like Alonso against Salah at all. I think that's been shown in the past that is a mismatch, and that's one that Liverpool will be looking towards. Also, the protection in the front of the defence has fallen away a little bit in recent weeks. I don't know whether, we touched on this at the beginning, I don't know whether that is an application problem or a tactical issue. It's really difficult to say at the moment just because of the many issues surrounding the club. But if you don't have that organisation, if you don't have players, defenders passing over marking responsibilities and filling gaps, someone like Salah is going to ruin you. And if Salah doesn't, then he's creating space for, I mean, think of the kind of the range, think of the accomplished range shooters that Klopp has there. Thiago, Luis Diaz, Naby Keita, Mane's not exactly bad from distance, is he? Henderson can cut you from distance sometimes as well. So it's a really difficult kind of pick your poison type situation. The best you can do is just, yeah, block up the middle and hope for the best. I mean, maybe Tuchel will come up with some better language than that for it, having won a European Cup, than just cross your fingers and close your eyes. But it is basically that, because, and that's a mark of respect, because he has played at such a high level this season.
Mm. You know, we've got Diogo Jota actually having his first lull at Liverpool, Migs. Do you think that's directly linked to the amazing impact that Diaz has made?
Maybe partly, and even if it's kind of a subconscious thing again, just because, like, you know, Jota must be looking at the kind of the reception Diaz getting. Hey, that used to be me. I was a new guy getting all the praise. It was now, and Diaz almost taking it up a level. And I like, and let's be fair also, kind of, Diaz is actually, he's a more exciting player. I mean, this isn't going to do down what Jota does, but Jota's main skill is basically kicking or heading the ball into the goal quite precisely.
Not a bad skill.
No, not at all. But Diaz, obviously, it's about, he can do that, but he's also about kind of where he gets the ball and so he runs at teams. So there's more of a dimension to his play. So it does feel like almost, I don't want to say he becomes an Origi for Liverpool, but someone like, it's almost as if it's kind of evolved a little bit to be where Jota's there when they just need to get the ball to someone in the box. Whereas Diaz kind of fits their overall play maybe a bit more. And hence, because I mean, I hadn't, the initial discussion was always going to, it was going to be about whether it was going to be Jota or Firmino, whether Diaz was going to eventually succeed Mane. Whereas what's actually happened is that Diaz has been the one playing through the centre with the two totemic forwards either side. But partly I think maybe it's also just one of those things that happens. I mean, sometimes, especially when a player has a great first year at a club, I mean, what you always hear from people in football and that work in kind of the preparation side and the analysis is that one very basic, basic and obvious reason that players do have a kind of a second season syndrome of their own is because everyone has now had a year to basically research them in the division. So they know more of what they're about and they can prepare against them more. And it means the player themselves has to adapt. And obviously Jota was in the Premier League before, but I suppose it's in his specific role in this Liverpool team. And suddenly everyone can now work around that. Whereas Diaz is a bit of an unknown quantity. So I do think that's fed into it. And also just, I suppose, the natural ebb and flow of form. And what spoke to it a bit, there was one chance Jota had against Villarreal in the first half, because he came off at half-time, where I did find myself thinking, 6 months ago, Jota just would have smashed that into the corner in that kind of typical, in that kind of Alan Shearer style he has. Whereas in this occasion, he hit it straight at Rui. And Rui, I mean, given his performances,
he actually saved it.
Not the best game.
Yeah.
No, you know, we spoke there about totemic players, you know, like Sadio Mane. He's having a season for the ages, isn't he, Seb? I know we've touched on this subject in the past, but I think it's worth dwelling upon the social impact, the force for good that a player like that can be, and someone like Salah, for instance. Is that something sometimes that we just overlook a bit?
Yeah, I think so. And here's a scenario for you. Liverpool probably not going to win the Premier League, but the end of this year, before the World Cup starts, because the Ballon d'Or is being voted for ahead of Qatar 2022, Sadio Mane might have won the European Cup, the FA Cup, the League Cup, and the Africa Cup of Nations in the same cycle.
And got them to the World Cup as well.
Yeah, 100%. And the thing I say about that is that there's a danger here that I hope dearly if he achieves all of those things, then he should win the Ballon d'Or. Because the problem is, if he doesn't, it creates this kind of perception that, it's just Africa Cup of Nations. Where in reality, it's an enormously difficult tournament to win. And Senegal winning it this season was an amazing accomplishment. Because for Mane personally, he had that nasty concussion situation in, I think, the first group game. And also, don't underestimate that, you know, unlike the European Championship or unlike a normal World Cup, you're not staging these tournaments in the middle of a break. You're staging in the middle of a hugely taxing domestic season during which you've already had the kind of the run of Premier League games and the kind of the exertions that go with having to play Wednesday, Sunday in the Champions League too. And he has kind of also been a talisman within that team because he's not the only excellent player that Senegal have, but he is their player, as in he is the kind of the poster of Senegalese football at the moment. And he's had to live with that burden. He's overcome it. and gone through the tournament and won the tournament. Socially, I think it's very, very important that you recognize that. And you don't just kind of go down the kind of, yeah, but who won the European Championship last year? Let's just give, I don't know, a Ballon d'Or to Jorginho. You know, that kind of stuff. I think it's very, 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 very important to anoint the right players at the right time now, especially in this kind of post-Ronaldo, post-Messi world. And I'd also say that, like, one of the kind of the more subtle threads that has gone through the season is Miguel mentioned the kind of the rises and falls of form. Now, Mane's a really good example of that because actually before Christmas, he was, I mean, only by his own standards, so it's a relative comment, but he wasn't at his very, very best. And he entered AFCON as, I don't know, kind of 7.5 out of 10 Sadio Mane's, you know, 7 Mane's to the usual 9, basically. And he came back and kind of compensated for Mohamed Salah's slight drop from a 10 out of 10 weekly performance to maybe an 8.5. Also, at times, he's played in a slightly adapted role. So Mane spent much of his season, much of the second half of the season, like through the middle, which is a role we haven't seen him in much before, almost doing kind of Roberto Firmino type things. So as a package, it's pretty hard to beat, right? As a kind of body of work in 2022, that is, I mean, that's right up there with whatever Karim Benzema does. So I hope that gets recognised. And I hope the AFCON side of it gets recognised too, because Senegal were by no means a lock to win that tournament. And, you know, there were some talented sides that kind of fell on their own, tripped over themselves during that competition as well. So what an amazing accomplishment that would be.
Certainly, I agree with that. The one thing that also strikes me, Migs, looking at Liverpool at the moment is, you know, the great managers are people developers, aren't they? And managers, you know, create other managers. I look at that squad and someone like Jordan Henderson, James Milner, they strike me as coaches in the making. Do they do the same thing to you?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, and given there's been so much talk, so many clips about that you see where they exert that influence on the squads, I think that's certainly the case. But then I suppose it's also possible, I suppose, we can lull ourselves into kind of a bit of a false perception of these things. I mean, look, say, at the Manchester United at the Ferguson era. So many of those we would have thought were going to be, you know, even future Manchester United managers. And how many actual league titles or Champions League do they have among them? Is there a league title among any former?
I think
I don't think there actually is.
I think Keane won like the first division with Sunderland.
Yeah, Keane won the Championship.
Obviously. Yeah,
and Keane was always held up as kind of the ultimate. I remember one line before he took the Sunderland job in 2006, there was one line going around that, you know, Keane made himself a great player, but he was born a great manager, which is obviously not something that's...
Hasn't stood up that one to time, has it, that well, really?
I suppose there's also the evolution of management there as well. I mean, to be honest, even if you want to flip on the other direction, whereas I think you're absolutely right in that Henderson looks definitely like a manager. When I was watching Steven Gerrard, who is his predecessor as a Liverpool captain, and let's be fair, a better player, I would never consider Gerrard a future manager. I thought he was too individualist, too almost introverted, personally. Obviously not as a footballer, but in terms of personality, to be a good manager yet. He's obviously won a title with Rangers, and despite some natural up and down, I think he's done a solid job at Villa. So yeah, I suppose to answer your question, it looks like it, but who knows?
Who knows indeed. In terms of the broader picture, Seb, the actual FA Cup itself, I know it's a pretty much an annual debate. You know, I think you know, being a traditionalist, it's a shame that the final is no longer seen as the natural end to a season, domestic season at least. How relevant is the FA Cup, and what more could be done to increase its relevance, do you think?
Very interesting question, that, because I suspect that the Premier League, the FA Cup, we've got to define our terms a little bit. I mean, in terms of what relevance means, I think supporters might redevelop some affection for it, because the game is changing in a way that means that a lot of competition is just completely unattainable. Like there's very little aspiration to be had in the game. The Premier League is dominated by clubs with enormous resources. The Champions League is, well, goodness knows what UEFA is trying to do to the Champions League at the moment. you know, in 10 years, maybe it will be played on the moon between two clubs who've had historic wildcards. I don't know, but it's not exactly the people's tournament, is it? And so what you're left with is an FA Cup, a League Cup to a less extent, but an FA Cup where, yes, still obviously dominated by big clubs, but you feel, despite those massive advantages, that it's still a bit more of an even playing field because one-off games are better for smaller clubs. They just are. Doesn't mean it's good, but it's better. And so it's the last thing that you can hope for. I mean, that might be a little bit fatalistic, but that seems to be where the game is going because I think if you look at the other competitions, it's not necessarily the failure to contain artificial advantages which troubles me. It's this newer habit of trying to eliminate competition altogether that I find really troubling, or the kind of a way of creating mulligans for very, very wealthy teams who spend all of their money badly. I think that's a very discouraging road that we're treading. And in a way, the FA Cup can never really do that because of its structure. And that's to its advantage. Now, I don't think it's going to ever develop the same kind of prestige or retain what it once was. It's never going to be the focal point of a season. It's never going to be the kind of the what everything leads to ever again, because that's just not how football works anymore. But I think it will be, I think it will lose that sort of, oh, it's only an FA Cup weekend feel that it's had for some time, and development more of a kind of, hey, it's a relief from the grind of being smashed 7-0 by the English Bayern Munich every week. You know, it's that, and I think that's in its favour, you know, used correctly, obviously, but it could be, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully indeed. And at least, you know, what a final is the essence of is knockout football, which I enjoy and love. So just as a final point then, chaps, quick prediction, please. Migs, who wins?
Oh, I didn't go to penalties.
Will they bring Kepa on for them?
Well, mate, and then you'd wonder whether, I mean, especially with the way penalties end up becoming a kind of a second-guessing operation, maybe Chelsea have actually learned now from February. And then, okay, Chelsea doing the penalties then. But
okay. Seb?
I'm going to go with Liverpool, and I'm going to be a bit more specific. I'm going to say that Luis Diaz has his kind of crowning moment. I think he'll cause havoc in that little area in front of the Chelsea defence, and cap a fantastic first half season. 2-0.
2-0. Well, I'll go with Liverpool as well. Look, we all know about the distractions and the cumulative drain on their energies, but there is something about this Liverpool team, actually this Liverpool squad, that takes it to another level. I think they'll drag out one more performance of intensity and intelligence and industry. Let's face it, they deserve to be associated with an historic achievement. In the meantime, thanks to Seb and Miguel for their insights, and thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams.
And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.